My name is Bill Owsley. I am the retired supervisor of the Kansas City FBI Organized Crime Squad. Read my book, Mobsters in Our Midst, and listen at ganglandwire.com.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. You know, we're into season three. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City with my good friend, Aaron, good friend and co-host. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, this is looking forward to being quite a season. You know, our listeners are going up all the time. They have been for the last several months. And anything you can do to spread the word, to get more people to listen to us, the better we're going to be. And maybe we'll end up getting some money and get some higher production values. Although, the only thing, we can't get any better stories. We can't talk any better. We can't be any funnier. We can't come up with any more details that we have come up with, but we could add maybe some music in. We could get a sound designer to do this, and we could maybe add some special effects, make it a little more interesting. I don't know.
Maybe we could get some Freedom Information Act requests.
We get some more detailed information from those Freedom Information Act requests that I cut way back. I got one the other day. I got the picture of a guy, and I'm waiting for the whole case file, not the whole case file, but it was going to be $250 for everything on this guy. And I just wanted about this one case that he was involved in, and I was involved in helping getting him arrested. And the person assured me that for the $25, they would be able to send me a good, solid, long report that would tell all about this case. So, hopefully I got that coming, and it takes forever. I ordered that about, I don't know, 8 months ago, a year ago at least. I've got several others in. I've used some of them. I've got some more. I got to sit down and create stories over, and I've done some of that, and I'll continue to do some more. Tonight, we're going to talk about an interesting story out of Chicago, the Chicago Outfit. You know, we did a lot of stuff out of Chicago. I'll tell you, there's a headline, Chicago Tribune, May 23rd, 1962. The headline was, Hit Auto Pair Freed, But the Secret's Out. Two crime syndicate hoodlums caught in a specially equipped car known as a hit car went free in court yesterday. But not before police uncovered the latest hoodlum tricks in doctoring up an automobile. Philip Milwaukee Phil Aldericio, 50, a gang hitman and loan shark, and Charles Nicoletti, 45, a West Side gambling boss, were freed by Judge Harry C. Comerford in auto court. Judge Comerford ruled the state failed to prove Aldericio and Nicoletti were guilty of using a fictitious address on the registration form for state license plates are displaying plates listed to a fictitious address. That happened, and there's a picture. I'll have that on the in the show notes on the website of the secret compartment in this car. What these guys did, and I guess before I get into that, interesting is in May of 1962, these same two guys and Tony Spilotro took part in the famous torture of Billy McCarthy. Just sometime within a few days of this, it sounds to me like, we don't know exactly when it happened, but Billy McCarthy disappeared about that time. And the reason you might know about this particular famous torture was because at the beginning of the film Casino, the Joe Pesci character has a guy's head in a vise, and he's squeezing the guy's head until his eye pops out, and that's the famous torture of Billy McCarthy. These two guys were arrested by the Racine Avenue police, which is, I think, kind of on the west side of Chicago, sitting in front of 17 Superior Street, 1750 Superior Street. It was 1962 Ford sedan. It was registered to an Alter Getz, A-L-T-E-R-G-E-T-Z, of Oaklawn, Illinois, which is a suburb. Police checked, and that was a vacant lot. So when they were arrested, what they did, they probably got a suspicious party call. I mean, I don't know how many suspicious party calls. Actually, I caught a kind of a mob associate and a couple other guys who were, I think back on this, I should have been a little more suspicious. They were just sitting in a neighborhood late at night with no lights on, and we got a call on a suspicious party, and we pulled up and got them out, and I recognized the name on this one guy, and he wasn't a made guy, but he was kind of an associate guy. And the other two were, they had that feel. I don't remember they had any kind of a record, but they just had that feel of professional criminals. And you know, they refused. They said they were waiting for his girlfriend to get home so he could go in. And we never could prove or disprove their story. We finally had to let him go. Well, that's what happened here. These Chicago coppers got a suspicious party call. I get there, and they find these two guys just sitting there, and they, you know, approach them and ask them, what are you doing? And you know, they probably knew these were mob guys at that point in time. They got them out of the car, and they started looking at the car, and they found this secret compartment that was big enough to put several guns in, that you would just punch a button, and this thing would flop open and behind the front seat, and you could hide your guns in there, and they happened to find that. And
it wasn't a very secret compartment then.
Well, I mean, I think they just got lucky. There's a picture of it. You'll have to judge for yourself how secret it was, I guess. The coppers probably just got lucky. Informants were telling them at the time, you know, after they started asking around, some of the Chicago coppers started asking around, said, you know, that was their hit car, and they used that for a getaway, and that's why they'd taken this car and specially registered it in a fictitious name. So if somebody picked up the tags, there were hidden switches under the dashboard. That's one thing that kind of got them onto, what are these switches? And two of these disconnected the taillights and the stoplights. The third switch turned on electric motor to open this hidden compartment in the back rest of the front seat. And then it had brackets, specially made brackets to hold shotguns or rifles, long guns, and handguns.
Well, no wonder they refused to answer any questions. Like, what's wrong with just a standard old gun rack in the back window?
In the back window. Well, this is not exactly in the back window. It was in a hidden compartment. Coppers held the... they're holding the car in the auto pound, and the auto in the tow. The coppers are holding the auto and the coppers are holding this car in the tow lot, and said it will be there until Walter Getz shows up and proves that he owns the car. I don't think Walter Getz ever showed up. Do you think he did?
Well, they could come up with some fake ID, I would think, that said the name. And although I would wonder if no one did show up, how long would the car sit there before they finally said, okay?
It will sit there until there'll be some kind of a standard period of time that if nobody claims a car, then they have an auction. I wonder who bought it at auction.
That would be to find out who bought that at auction.
Actually, in Chicago, I tell you what, I bet they did. They probably just waited until it went up at auction. They got the fix in, and then the people at the tow lot who ran the auction then knew that they needed to take this one guy's bid. They probably bought it back for $50.
And put it back into service.
More than likely. Tell you a little bit about these guys. Charles Chucky Anthony Nicoletti, born in 1916. He was known as the typewriter, or Chucky typewriter. I'm wondering where that name came from. You know, like rat-a-tat-tat, like typewriter. I don't know. He was known as a top Chicago outfit hitman under the outfit boss Sam Mooney Giancana, and both before and after Giancana's rise and fall. After Giancana was killed, Chucky Nicoletti, he continued to work for the outfit. He was not particularly tied to Giancana. I think he might have been one of the 42 gang members with Sam Giancana back in the 20s and 30s before he went into the outfit. His family, of course, was a poor family from Sicily. They lived on the west side of Chicago, which is probably what you would call Little Italy, 737 South Campbell Avenue. Anybody wants to go by and check that out, 737 South Campbell Avenue in the west side of Chicago. He started out early. At age 12, 1929, he shot and killed his own father, supposedly in self-defense. His father was a drunkard. He regularly beat his wife and kids. Finally, the kid didn't take it anymore. The Chicago records state that Chucky ran into the bedroom. His father was chasing him, and he had a gun kept in a bureau drawer, and he turned around and shot him. He was exonerated. Now, he did. He was a member of the 42 gang. I see now in my notes. I'd forgotten that. I thought that was right. He was a member of the 42 gang, which was Mad Sam DiStefano, which we've done a story on him, was part of the 42 gang. And Mad Sam's the reason that they, Tony Spilotro and Chucky and Milwaukee Phil, were even squeezing that dude's head in the vise. It was DiStefano that sent him after that guy. He was a loan shark.
That ran in, must have known that there was a gun in that bureau drawer.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Last thing you want to do is be looking around for a gun when somebody's coming at you with a knife.
Yeah, I'm
sure
he did.
Especially if it's your dad.
Yeah. Well, if your dad's drunk, you can probably...
Not talk him out of it.
Not talk him out of it. It's another dysfunctional family raising children.
So he fit in well with these other outfit guys from Giancana's...
Yes.
Crew.
Right. So I'd imagine all these guys that were involved in this torture and murder had dysfunctional childhoods growing up. Don't you imagine? Probably been whacked around all their life growing up. Nicoletti was known by the FBI and the Chicago police to be one of the most feared trigger men in Chicago, and they knew he had teamed up with Alderesio to form a hit team. We talked about Bill Romer Jr., who was a FBI agent, a real ball-busting FBI agent up in the Chicago, up in the city of Chicago. Remember we talked about Agent William F. or Bill Romer Jr.? He was a real ball-busting agent up in Chicago. He was the one that go over and question Mad Sam DiStefano, and Mad Sam would have his wife make coffee, and they'd bring him the coffee, and he claimed later that he'd been urinating in Romer's coffee. I'm sure that made the rounds, that story.
So I'm guessing he didn't say anything about the cookies.
Right. Romer also would go visit Nicoletti periodically, trying to make him an informant. That's part of the FBI's deal. They just go out and visit these guys every once in a while, Romer said that Nicoletti always said that he worked at a car dealership, one of several different car dealerships, and he was always cordial, and when they call and check with the car dealership, they'd always say, yeah, he works there. We had a guy in Kansas City that used to do that for a couple of mob guys. If you'd call up there, they'd say, oh, yeah, he works there, but he didn't really work here. But Nicoletti never flipped, and he never talked to the FBI. Even though there was rumors that he'd flipped, but they do that all the time. They get paranoid as heck. It's been alleged that
that happened to Tokyo Joe.
Tokyo Joe,
went into
yeah.
the wrong courthouse.
Exactly.
No one saw him, and he wasn't even doing
anything. That was Action Jackson.
Action Jackson.
He went in the Milwaukee courthouse, and they thought he'd flipped. Ito, they thought he was going to flip. He had a case on him. I'll tell you what, man, if you get a case on you in Chicago back in these days, they don't trust that you're going to do your time,
yeah,
I don't think.
You're going to catch more than a case.
Yeah, really.
You're going to catch a cartridge.
It's been alleged by different people that Nicoletti was involved in as many as 20 mob hits in his career. He was even implicated by somebody in a 2010 Playboy magazine article that said he had something to do with the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. There's some inmate in the Illinois Department of Corrections was alleging this. I don't really believe that, but it makes for a good article. March 29th, 1977, our good friend, the typewriter, Chucky Typewriter, was sitting in his car in a parking lot at the Golden Horns Restaurant in suburban Northlake, Illinois, when he came up with three .38 caliber slugs in the back of his head. Now, I don't know whether somebody's able to get in the car behind him, or they just walked up and got him to turn his head one way and then walked up to the other door. I tell you what you could do. You'd have two guys. One would walk up to one side, and he'd turn to look at you, and then another guy would walk up the other side and pop you in the back of the head.
And not even get in the car.
And his car was running because it continued to run. The hitmen took off, and the car overheated and caught on fire, which drew the attention of the police. He was still alive, but he died a few hours later in the hospital. Bill Romer in Chicago accuses Chicago mob hitman Harry Aleman as the suspected hitman. We need to do a story on Harry Aleman. I've got a bunch of notes on him. And he was a cold dude, too. He was the one suspected of killing Sam Winnett, the guy that put the two dudes in the... killed the guys and put them in the two barrels, the janitor in a drum case. If you remember that, Harry Aleman was accused of killing this Sam Winnett. They found his body strangled up at the O'Hare National Airport in the parking lot. Nicoletti's buried at Mount Carmel Cemetery in Hillsdale, Illinois, and not too far from Al Capone. And Mount Carmel Cemetery in Illinois has several Chicago organized crime figures buried there.
Not just Al Capone.
Not just Al Capone. I can't remember who. I think maybe Iupa's buried there and Accardo. But quite a few of them are buried at this one. We've got one over here on the east side of Kansas City. It's got a lot of the guys out of the 30s and 40s and all the way up. Nick Savella's buried there. The more modern guys don't continue that down that path.
But they killed Nicoletti because they thought he had flipped.
They thought he had flipped, yeah.
Not that they had evidence of it or because... If he had flipped, not that the FBI would come out and say anything, but wouldn't there be some substantive evidence? Like he would come forward and, like Ken Ito, they would get a affidavit from him, or a confession or something?
Well, he had flipped, but he hadn't been exposed as flipping yet by the FBI. The only reason Ken Ito came out and testified and gave him that affidavit about who was doing what was because he had gone in the witness protection program. They had tried to kill him.
Yeah.
Well, here, like Nicoletti, if he'd have lived, then he might have gone ahead and done the same thing. He could have been just giving them information. He could have been what they call a top echelon informant, just giving them good background information. Lots of those guys that do that in order to further their own ends, they take care of competition that way. They'd rat out somebody else in order to get them a catch a case and go away, and then they could take over their loan shark customers or take over their joint or
whatever,
take over their action
is.
Whatever their racket. Yeah, that's pretty common. There's no honor among thieves. Now, the other guy that was in that hit car, Felix Anthony Milwaukee Phil Aldericio, and he was a enforcer and a bag man, a hit man, a burglar, and he was also the underboss for Sam Giancana. He came up in the 42 gang with Giancana himself. Said he used to wait outside the hotel, the Lexington Hotel in Cicero, for Al Capone to try to get a job as a messenger in the Capone organization. He had a cousin, Louis Fratto, who had already got into the outfit under Capone, and he brought Aldericio in. Started working with Sam Battaglia and Marshall Caifano. Marshall Caifano, he's a buddy of Red Wimette's. He's a guy that moved up to the ranks to like an underboss and then kind of got in trouble, and they demoted him to soldier, and he ended up moving to Florida, and he never got out of the mob, and he always had action going. But he got demoted, if you will.
Well, it's better than the alternative.
Yeah, really, much better. Aldericio, as he came up through the mob ranks, he gained a reputation for brutality. He was a guy that could take care of business and torture people and beat them and do whatever needed to be done. He worked under Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, who was the Chicago Outfit's financial expert, and doing that, Greasy Thumb Guzik was a guy that delivered all the payoffs to Chicago judges and higher echelon police officials, and Aldericio became his bag man, so he got to know everybody that was taking the money, who was taking the money and who wasn't. He's suspected of carrying out 13 or 14 hits for the outfit. He had a crew that worked under him would have been probably Most of them would not have been made guys, all been professional criminals associates, and they were well-known cat burglars. They were very skillful cat burglars, and they operated in Chicago's upscale downtown. They called it the Gold Coast District. His crew, Alderiso's crew, specialized in rare gems and jewelry, which they would then fence out through outfit-controlled jewelry stores. Like, for example, Tony Splatro, when he moved out to Las Vegas, he opened the Gold Coast, the Gold Rush jewelry store in Las Vegas, and he fenced a lot of jewelry. Remember we did that?
He used that as his front.
Right, it was his front. Right, and they were going out doing jewelry store robberies. And if you remember, it was suspected that Marlboro diamond maybe got sent out to Tony Splatro out in Las Vegas, and he got it cut up by somebody working with him and fenced it. So they had these different. We had one in Kansas City, actually. I won't mention the name of it. I think maybe they're still in business. I don't know. No, they're probably not. But anyhow, they were a mob front. We once served a search warrant on them. We went in, and in every corner of the back room of that jewelry store, there was a shotgun, a loaded shotgun standing there. Now, that was not for the police. That was for if they got robbed, because whenever you are you're dealing with all these criminals that are coming in selling you stolen goods, you're at risk to be robbed by one of these criminals or one of these criminals' buddies that knows you keep a lot of cash in that place. So
if you're selling stolen jewelry, then who are you going to report it to if they rob you?
Exactly. It's like robbing the drug dealer, like Omar Little, or what was our guy's name? We did the story on robbing drug dealers.
Craig Glazier.
Yeah, Craig Glazier, yeah. Who were his victims going to tell?
Yeah, the King of Sting.
Denman kid got his name when Mario was his uncle. He was robbing drug dealers. He's the one that a drug addict was inside the drug house and he killed everybody. He thought he killed everybody in the drug house. He didn't kill Bernard Wolfskill, but he drove a knife down through his mouth and it came out the back of his throat and impaled him against the floor when the police got there. These guys, you got to be a bad dude to rob another criminal, and especially somebody like that's connected to the Chicago outfit. I don't know if they ever got robbed up there or not. They probably did. They wouldn't make a complaint, though, would they? Would you make a complaint, Aaron?
Well, I would about being stabbed. How it all went down, I don't know. I might... leave that to their discretion.
Right. If you live in that subculture and another one of these guys robs you, it's pretty hard to make a complaint. You're not calling 911 and asking the police to come over and take an offense report, are you?
Well, but you get stabbed like that in the neck with a knife, you're probably going to go to the hospital.
Yeah, he didn't have a choice but to say, here's what happened. Yeah. They had him. Otherwise, if that hadn't happened, he'd have just got up and walked out there and forgot it happened. He would have never called the police. I remember that guy. I tried to make him into a snitch. His name was Bernard Wolfskill, and he would not. I had a pretty good case on him, and he would not rat anybody out. You know what's funny is I ended up letting him go. I kind of dropped the ball on that. I should have gone back after him and got that case filed, and I didn't do it. Oh, well. He got a free ride on that one and never had to pay anything, even information.
Now, what about Alderiso?
Well, Alderiso, he and his crew were, since they'd worked for Guzik, and they were responsible for picking up payoffs from Northside restaurants, Chicago Northside, near Northside restaurants, Rush Street nightclubs, and was really the principal bag man for all the bookmaking operations, and would deliver millions of dollars every week to the other members of the outfit, probably up to... then counted out and divided up with Giancana and Guzik and Murray the Camel Humphreys, and they'd use it to pay off policemen and aldermen, and somebody take a package over to Tony Accardo. You know, if you ever watched in The Sopranos, I know you guys see that in Sopranos, where somebody just walk up and hand Tony Soprano a thick envelope of money. Well, that's how it works. You go out and make a bunch of cash money, and then you divide it up, and one package will go to the boss, and another package will maybe go to your don, your crew chief, your capo regime, your leader of your crew, and then he has to take that on up to the underboss, and the underboss will take some on to the boss. That's just how it works, and this guy was just part of that. He was a collector dude because he was a bad dude.
Well, he was a bag man, so he's collecting the money and bringing it back, but then he also was a...
He was a hitman, and he had a burglary crew, too. He had all kinds of action going on. He was once brought in to the Senate Committee on Government Operations Investigations on Organized Crime. Got him in front of that, gave him the oath, and he pled the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination 23 times and refused to testify. That was a pretty important, pretty important for him that he be seen as pleading the Fifth 23 times, I would imagine. Although in Chicago, you know, they still going to start looking at you when you start drawing a lot of attention. He also participated in that famous mob torture instrument. What had happened after a barroom brawl, a couple of small-time criminals, Billy McCarthy and Jimmy Moralia, ambushed and killed a couple of outfit associates, Ron Scalvo and Phil Scalvo. Aldericio Nicoletti, his partner in the hit car, and Tony Splatro captured up McCarthy and tortured him. That's when the eye-popping thing came out and got him to give up Moralia, and then they captured Moralia and killed him right off the bat. And about a week later, they were both found in a car with their throats cut. Aldericio was kind of an interesting guy. I found this little tidbit about him. He liked to travel. He often traveled abroad. Now, some people suspicion that he was setting up heroin connections in the Middle East, because he went to the Middle East. He went to Turkey and Italy and Greece. But he was really passionate about the ruins that he saw, and he spent hours photographing them. And there probably was a tape at one time, but there was a hidden mic in a room where he was meeting with Giancana, and they said he spent about 20 minutes describing ruins he had recently seen in Europe, and finally Giancana lost patience and said, "Phil, goddamn it, ruins. I got coppers coming out of my eyeballs, and you sit there telling me about ruins. Listen to me, Phil. Listen real good. Ruins ain't garbage. Forget about them goddamn ruins." They work for a boss that'd like yell at you like that, tell you to shut up. I did once. He was a nutcase.
What's he mean he's got coppers coming out of his eyeballs?
Oh, it means he's got coppers. He's got police all over him. He's got surveillance.
See, oh, okay.
At this point in time.
Like coppers, like,
oh, yeah, no.
like the metal.
Right, no.
What does that mean?
He means police, FBI agency. At this point in time, they had a deal in Chicago called Operation Lockstep. Have you ever heard of that, Aaron?
No.
Well, Operation Lockstep, and Bill Romer was part of this. They got really aggressive. You know, he was part of that Top Hoodlum program, and Giancana was the known leader of the Chicago outfit at that time, even though Anthony Accardo was probably maybe the back-behind leader. Sam Giancana was the out-front leader, and what they did, they assigned agents to just get behind him, and they would like get in a car, and they didn't like secretly surveil him. They got right on his bumper, and when he got out to go in the restaurant, they'd get out and go in the restaurant and get in the table right next to him, or as close as they could get to him. They would then follow him wherever he went. If he went in the store, they just get in, and he's walking around shopping, they just walk around and follow him. If he went home, they just sit right in front of his house. If he went to play golf, they would then go to the golf club people, the golf starter, and say, "Hey, we want to be the foursome. We're the FBI. We want to be the foursome right behind these guys here." And so they would play right behind him. And often Bill Romer was a big, strong guy, and he would drive the ball right up into their.
He'd come through and ask if he could play through.
And he didn't ask to play through. He just drove the ball right up into him. And they got so mad about that. And that's what he means. He had his coppers coming out of his eyeballs. He got so mad and so discombobulated by that, he ends up filing a lawsuit against the FBI. And here was the ruling. You ever heard of this ruling, Aaron, out of this case, the Operation Lockstep? The ruling was, if you're following a mobster and they're playing golf, you have to stay at least one foursome behind them. That was the best he could get out of the court. But they couldn't stop him from following him.
Everywhere else, it didn't count.
Well, I mean, it.
Like in traffic, you had to leave at least one car between you
No, you don't have to do that.
If you're parked out front of the house, you have to be one house between.
Don't have to do that. But if you're playing golf, you got to stay one foursome behind them. That's probably because Romer was driving up into him. The judge probably was a golfer himself, and you hate to have somebody drive up into you. Aldericio was arrested 36 times over the years for assault and battery, bombing, racketeering, loan sharking, gambling, hijacking, narcotics, counterfeiting, bootlegging, bribery, extortion, and murder for hire. But he always avoided prosecution because of, you know, at this point in time in the 70s and 80s, especially the 60s and 70s, they pretty well owned the court system in Chicago, the Cook County court system. The outfit pretty well owned it. They can get done whatever they want done. You know what their deal was. They would, if it was a bad case, they would get it transferred to a particular judge. The judge would then say he was going to have a bench trial. They would ask for a bench trial. The judge would grant that, and then they'd have a bench trial, and then he'd just say not guilty. And once you've said not guilty on that, then double jeopardy applies, and you can't be tried again. Although they did make a run on that after they proved that one of those judges up there in Chicago had been taking bribes and had done this little scheme. I think they did go back and maybe it was Harry Ailman and tried him again for a crime that he'd gotten a not guilty on.
But basically, the FBI had to come in and kind of shake it all up.
Yeah, you know, they had to prove that these judges were taking
bribes,
and they had to prove that in a particular case, the judge took a bribe and ruled against the evidence and found Tony Spilotro, he got it done for himself, got a not guilty, even though it was only because the judge took a bribe. They got it. And again, it's a strong tenet of American law that you cannot be tried twice for the same crime, no matter what happens. But in this case, I believe they overruled the double jeopardy objection and did try somebody twice. That'd be an interesting case. I'll have to look that up and research that a little bit.
Well, obviously, in the case of Aldericio,
yeah,
he when they found this particular car and they impounded it, the charges that they had against them were dropped.
Right. There was really nothing you could charge him with. Charge him with sitting in a car that was owned by somebody else that was registered to a vacant lot. You're never going to make a case on that. It was just kind of interesting, a little bit of intelligence. Aldericio,
I wonder if they, after that, they moved the switches a little bit. Like, maybe let's want to shut the lights off and the brake lights off, but let's move that other one to open up the gun compartment somewhere else.
Make it a little more hidden. Yeah. Or did we try to be a little slicker on it? Either that or not, just not get caught by the police. Yeah. I think you could probably get stopped 50 times by the police in that car, and they would never notice that. I don't know exactly why they noticed it that night. The article didn't go into it.
Maybe those were some new cops.
Probably young guys.
Probably, maybe it was Officer Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I'm going to find something. Let me check underneath the dash.
Yeah, would come in on his own time or something. Actually, you know what might have happened? They might have had an informant who said, hey, they're driving this specially equipped hit car, and you need to go check it out. And so they looked, and they got him stopped and went over it with a fine-tooth comb. Although, according to the article, the police just stumbled onto him and said they were just sitting in the car, so who knows.
Maybe the informant was the guy they were out to get.
Yeah, could be. You know, there was somebody. You know they're running surveillance on somebody. That's during the time when they were kidnapping that Jimmy Moralia. So it might have been him. They might have been sitting there trying to snag him off the street. Or the other guy, Billy McCarthy. Eventually, he becomes acting boss for a while, but he wasn't very popular, they say, and soon was demoted back and eventually convicted of extortion and sent to the penitentiary. In September 25th, 1971, Felix Aldericio, or Milwaukee Phil, dies of natural causes in the United States Penitentiary in Merriam, Illinois. You know, I wonder, we have to ask our friend Martin about him. That's where Martin was, Martin McNally of the D.B. Cooper. He was in Merriam at the same during in 1971, wasn't he? No, he didn't go in until 73 or 4. So, no, he wouldn't have known him. He probably did know some mob guys.
He was in Leavenworth at first.
At first, yeah. And so it was the middle 70s by the time he got up to Merriam.
I'm kind of curious, just why would they call Aldericio Milwaukee Phil?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. Any Chicago guys out there know that?
I mean, he was a Chicago guy.
Hit me up.
Kind of insulting, wouldn't it? Like, I'm a Chicago guy.
Call me
Milwaukee Phil.
He probably killed somebody from Milwaukee once. I don't know.
Maybe that's how he made his bones.
It might be. He probably tortured somebody from Milwaukee, or he extorted money from somebody from Milwaukee.
Maybe Walter Goetz.
Or he liked to go up to Milwaukee a lot. He had a girlfriend up there or something. Who knows? You never know how people get some Chucky typewriter. You know, how did he get that nickname? How did he get that moniker? Mooney Giancana, how do you get that moniker? They got some great nicknames up there, monikers up in Chicago, the outfield. We don't have that many good monikers down here that I know about.
William Willie Potatoes.
Potatoes, yeah. Mad Sam, Teets, Teets Battalia.
William Willie Potatoes Dadano.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Dadano. William Willie Potatoes Dadano. I have to look. I don't really, know not, him. Like, I've seen that name before. He was a pretty important mobster.
Much like Clean Face, if you don't have a mob nickname, you really aren't anybody.
That's true. That is true. Unless you're Nick Savella. Nick Savella never had a nickname, although they did call
Uncle
him Zio.
Nick.
Uncle. Unc. They called him Unc or Uncle, some of the inside guys, but that was not a nickname anybody on the street would know. Or Zio, which is Italian for uncle. And I guess in a way, he was Tuffy's uncle by marriage. Because Tuffy's sister was married to his nephew. Well, he was his uncle, in a way. Twice removed. A shirt-tail relative, as we call him up home. All right, well, that's the story of the Chicago hit car. Pretty interesting story. If you have, it reminds me of my... public service announcement. One of these days, folks, I might get some advertisers and I'll quit doing this public service announcement, but I may still continue to do that. Let me know if you ever want me to quit doing the public service announcement. I have long supported First Call. If you have a friend or a relative or a worker, a coworker, a subordinate, a superior at work that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your First Call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say that folks need to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. I'm telling you, you ought to update it with some of these Chicago locations just because.
I need to create a whole mob tour app in Chicago. Sounds to me like there is one up there, but it's just for Capone sites.
And you got to remember to get the book that just came out, Leaving Vegas.
The true story of how FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
With recordings, wiretap recordings from the mouth of the men that did it. And you can rent or own the streaming copy of Gangland Wire, the documentary that started Gary Jenkins down this path.
Well, actually, it started down the path in 1976 when I was transferred into the intelligence unit, but this is just a continuation of a long path and fighting the mob in Kansas City, in Chicago, Milwaukee, Cleveland, Las Vegas.
New York.
I never really made it to New York. I need to research and do some New York stories. I just don't have that much personal experience. So
we need to do St. Louis.
St. Louis. Yeah, there's not much out of St. Louis. I never had much of a mob. They had Jim, was it something, Giordano. We never, you know what's interesting about that, Aaron? We never had any relationship with the St. Louis mob. They did have a family, but we didn't have any relationship business-wise. They had Giordano had relationships, and Morris Schenker, who was a St. Louis lawyer, who was Jimmy Hoffa's lawyer and connected to the Teamsters. They had a relationship with Chicago a little bit, but mainly with the Detroit mob for some reason. They were much closer to Detroit. It's like Cleveland was close to the Genovese family in New York City, while Kansas City and Milwaukee were real close to the Chicago outfit. Part of it's geography, I would imagine.
And relationships.
And relationships that go way back. That,
like Nick Savella making a run to Chicago
had to hide out in Chicago for a while.
And he had a hit out on him.
Right. And Milwaukee would be geography because they're so close. I mean, it's what, two hours from downtown, an hour from the north suburbs.
Well, folks, you got to thank Gary Jenkins for putting his time in at the Kansas City Police Department. 25 years he spent as a police officer.
It was a fun ride.
And it's fascinating and interesting stories. And he met a lot of folks that he's been able to get back in touch with. And they've come forward and they've shared some of their stories, which you can enjoy when you go to ganglandwire.com.
This podcast is truly from the mouths of the men who did it, for the most part. Tonight was not, but mainly that's what we try to do. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Have anything to say, sir?
Anything at all, sir?
I got nothing to say. I got nothing to do with this.
Are you guilty?
Of course not.
Rhodes, now that's the secret word. If you hear the word, if you text me, 931-3535-816, or if you email me, ganglandwire@gmail.com, or if you comment on this particular show and the website, just use the word Rhodes, and we will know that you listen to the secret story afterwards. Aaron, since this is going to come up long after the book, but I just went back over the book today and got it all ready, working with a formatter to get it all formatted to go up onto Kindle. You'd think that would be easy, but it's not. I thought I could do it when I first started this thing, and I looked at the way to do it, and I thought, I can do this, but it turns out it's pretty hard to do.
I thought you already had it because you had the printed copy. You would think it'd be pretty easy to...
No, you got to
kind of flow that into an electronic copy.
Well, I mean, you don't have to rewrite anything, but you got to format it a certain way, and then you got to put links in to go to the wiretaps. I'd already put up all the little video clips for the wiretaps so I could link to them. They're on the internet, so you can link to them and click on them, and you go right to the wiretap, and then I've got captions so you can like listen to the wiretap and you can read what they're saying, but you can hear the voices. But it was kind of a deal. And then she got screwed up in her links, and I had to help straighten that one out. And then we were linking to the affidavits for the Breckenridge Inn and the Villa Capri wiretaps, and I had to go figure that one out because that wasn't working for some reason. You know, whenever you're doing stuff on the computer, there's always something that goes wrong. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong. And however long you think it'll take longer. Have you found that to be your experience?
Always seems to be the case.
Especially that however long you think it'll take longer. I don't know how many times I said, I'll take care of this. Take me about 5 minutes. And next thing I know, it's 20 minutes later. I'm screaming at the computer. It's a pain in the ass. I know that. Well, let's see. What other kind of mob stories we want?
Well, but here's what you got. You've got a great book.
I know. We need to get some.
You know, you've got some fresh content to promote that people really need to go and get.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to get the ebook up here.
Well, hopefully they will. We can start getting a little money in here.
And folks, well, that's your book.
Well, we're promoting it.
Promoting your book like we're promoting your movie.
We need to get a little. Like, you know, we haven't promoted Big Dumb Fun Show for a while either.
What we haven't promoted is the fact that if you are really a true fan of Gangland Wire, you know that for the right amount of money, you can have your own personalized tour
of Kansas City. Yeah,
Kansas City.
You just
got
to come
locations.
To Kansas City.
If you're here, if you're on vacation here, a couple hours, $200-$400, you and four of your friends could ride around in an unmarked car.
Yeah, in your unmarked car. Yeah, I don't have a car that big. I don't have an SUV. The last one I did, the guy had a big SUV and had a third seat back there. That's what we need.
And then we'll have you drop Gary off somewhere else. And what we suggest you do is you go to Anthony's for their $15 lunch.
Anthony's a real deal. You felt like you walked right back into the 1960s mob kind of restaurant. It's a good restaurant. The people that own it are not mobsters, but
it's authentic.
It's
Italian.
Authentic Italian. Yes, it is. And there's a lot of the mob guys that are still around go in there. It's a long held tradition in the Kansas City Italian community to go eat at Anthony's periodic because they got the real deal Southern Italian. They don't have any of that foo-foo Northern Italian fancy sauces and veal and everything. They've got lasagna and manicotti and spaghetti and meatballs, and they use local Mendolia sausage for their Italian sausage and warm, soft white bread that comes with every meal. And there's only one salad dressing, I think. I've never asked for anything, is the house dressing, which is, of course,
Italian
dressing. It's a great place.
It is. But that's the point is being that you get that authentic Italian experience, and then you go take a tour,
yep,
and see the authentic Italian homes and businesses, and you don't talk about it at the restaurant.
You see the places. You see the places where the men fell. Take them over to the 8th and Wabash there, where they found David Bonadonna's body in the trunk of his car, but it's right in the middle of the projects.
Wait, that sounds like a mob story you might be telling as bonus material.
Yeah, it right could now. Be. The time Willie Camisano Jr. lured him into his body shop and garage about a few blocks away. When we had a witness. They knew he was in trouble, and this David Bonadonna, and they had a witness that saw his green Mustang go into the shop and the door closed. And the same witness was out on the street somewhere close by. He must have been working outside or something. And he said, like an hour later, this green Mustang backed out and drove off. And he never did see who was actually driving it, but he said whoever drove it off, it was a standard transmission. He acted like he didn't know how to drive a standard transmission because he was so jerky with it. Which is kind of suspicious because the guy that owns a car, a standard transmission car, knows how to drive a standard transmission. About you, Aaron, you know how to drive a standard transmission?
I do.
Well, good. You know, there's a lot of young people that don't.
I don't own a car. I can drive an automatic and a manual.
Well, you're very skilled, very skilled. You know, I had a guy when I
grew up on the farm.
Yeah,
so
that's right. You did. You know, I had a guy who grew up in the city that came to work for me in the TAC unit, SWAT team. And we have this thing. It was called the V-100. It was an old, I want to say, not like an armored personnel carrier. We called it the tank. It was a metal-clad body on a truck frame, and it had a standard transmission. So this new kid, he's new in the TAC unit, and you need to be able to drive the tank just in case. Everybody needs to know how to drive the tank and at least be able to, you know, get it moving just in case some, you know, the shit hits the fan, man. And you're in the tank, and you're the only one there. You got to be able to drive it. So we put this kid in. He doesn't say anything. He didn't know how to drive a stick, and he tries to fake it. It did not work out well. Finally, I just took him out of it and said, you know, just forget about it, man.
if everything goes to hell, I guess we're screwed.
We're going to shoot you. We're going to throw you out front. Right. We'll sacrifice you, dude.
Yeah, when it comes to rescuing everybody, you're not going to be driving the tank.
Really? He didn't last very long in his squad. He kind of lost everybody's respect when he couldn't drive the tank that day. And he wasn't that good a policeman. Now. There was no hope for him.
He didn't recover.
He could never recover from that. If you're going to be a policeman in a SWAT team, you got to be able to do a lot of stuff. You got to be physically fit and a good shot and a decent personality that can get along with your other squad members and a good work ethic, and you just got to have a lot of qualities that every policeman doesn't have. A lot of them, they can't get along with other people. A lot of them, they not very physically fit.
What about a lot of them that are just overly eager?
And some of them are overly eager, yeah. We've seen that, and they don't last very long either in that really dangerous, tense kind of stuff where you need a lot of discipline. You don't need some overly eager, immature young copper out there. We told this one kid once, he's brand new, he's overly eager. I was a district sergeant then, and his sergeant, we get him in and say, you know, Kevin, you got to slow down, man. You're going to get hurt out here, because he was just balls to the wall, constantly running around, stopping people, jacking with people, and he wasn't very diplomatic either. He's making a lot of enemies, and so we're trying to instruct him that in the way to go to get the job done, but to do it right without irritating a lot of people and to stay safe. And you could tell it was just like he thought we were a couple of old codgers that didn't know anything. And And so he says, well, this other guy's name was Mike. He said, well, what about Mike? He said, he'll stop people all by himself and not call any help over unless he really thinks he needs it. And we said, Kevin, Mike's been around for 20 years. He knows how to back off. He knows that he doesn't have to prove himself. You don't. No. Oh, okay. That kid, he ended up getting fired in a few years. It took him a while.
He didn't want to be the guy that came back out and, on a call and rescued him.
Right, right. So there's something to be said for experience on that job.